Welcome to Medea Vox. My name is Temi Odemosu and I'm Senior Lecturer in Cultural Studies at K3 at Malmö University. And I'm here today speaking with Patrick McCurdy, and you are Assistant Professor in Communication at the University of Ottawa.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Associate Professor.
Associate Professor, great. So today is the first day of the Nord Media Conference. Patrick, you have just given the keynote for the conference, talking about the graphic novel The Beast, which is a novel that explores the issue of the oil and tar sands environmental crisis in Alberta, in Canada, and uses the mode of the graphic novel in order to explore issues of precarity, the relationship between two characters who, in a way, are sort of on either side of the debate. And you came to Nord Media to present the novel, but also to use it as a way to think about how we communicate challenging topics in the field of media and communication studies, and more broadly in academia in terms of knowledge production. Who are your stakeholders? How do you tell stories? What is the power of art to activate and mobilize different kinds of change thinking? So let's begin with the kind of origins of the project.
Sure.
What is The Beast? And why did it come into being?
Sure. The Beast, it's a graphic novel, both in print form, the Dead Tree version, as well as a digital version. The Beast itself came from a larger research project into the oil sands, tar sands debate. I moved back to Canada in 2011, and when I moved back to Canada, a lot of my back sort of research is on social movements. And when I moved back to Canada, I wanted to still do social movements, but not just social movements. So I picked the oil sands, tar sands debate, which was really heating up. I got a grant to create this online database of oil sands, tar sands propaganda. The idea was to get images dating from the 1960s up until present day. So we would we built this database from scratch with a partnership with Computer Science. I then traveled to a number of archives in Alberta. I would photograph images, scan them, source them, as well as do a lot of like archival digging online using the Wayback Machine, trying to find images. For example, say the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers had deleted a YouTube video. Well, they hadn't deleted it yet from their Vimeo page or their Facebook page, so I then would download it and put it up into this database. So this started to have me sort of work on this idea of this battle over images. And I wrote some academic sort of articles on it, but wanted to try and find a way to communicate this in a different way, which wasn't just a book chapter or an academic article. So a colleague of mine, he suggested make a comic. And so it sort of went from there, and that's what we have, The Beast.
So you talk about this war or battle of images, and yet the novel itself is another set of images included in this really contested debate.
Yeah.
So what does this new set of images do that the other images that you've been looking at don't?
That's a great question. Yeah, because it tries to sort of process these images. The comic form, the visual nature, and the idea of sort of short, sort of pithy narrative as well is a great way to have a tour through this battle and through this struggle. So it's something that having studied this database I'm talking about has over 2,800 images. And so I've looked at all these and you start to develop themes and you develop more themes in sort of doing analysis in some academic articles. And then in creating a timeline of the movement, you start to get an idea of the narrative. And so then telling a story through this is a way to do it. However, what's slightly odd about The Beast is that, I mean, it's not comics journalism, right? It's not like, on this date, this company was founded on this date, you know, on April 28th, 2008, 1,606 ducks died at a tailings pond. Well, that happened. We have dead ducks as a trope in the comic, but it's using like the fictional narrative is a lot easier to sort of cut through some of this stuff and also examine some of the tropes. Fiction by its very nature requires sort of like little almost simple stories and ideas, and that's where the tar sands debate has gotten to. So it was a way to try and achieve that with the help of Nicole Burton and Hugh Goldrick of at Astra Comics, who were crucial to thinking through this, because I am not a comics scholar. I don't draw comics. So it really was this partnership to try and make this idea happen.
You say in the introduction to The Beast, because there's an extended introduction to the online version that everybody can download for free, you say that struggles over the environment, climate change, and energy transition are equal struggles for our imagination. So what are the ways in which the comic sort of grapples with this notion of the imagination, both in terms of the imagined future of the planet, but also, again, the imaginary of the space of the comic itself?
Neat. Maybe I'm biased. I'm, you know, in communications, but it is about sort of the possibilities. And so I think the struggle for the imagination, I mean, even the fact that I did this comic, it wasn't in my imagination or field of possibilities until the idea was put in there, right? And so what the comic tries to do is put, sort of see what does that playing field look like. And to me, it looks like a tailings waste pond, which is just like a where you dump all the, after bitumen has been processed, it's where all the chemical and slurry and crap goes to. And that's sort of what the public discourse is like. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, like for the imagination, the one of the key features and something that I requested that that is added to the comic was some color. And I wanted to have these six full color page advertisements because those try and sort of like condense and address these tropes used in the advertising. But then in terms of like, what does this contested field look like? Well, I mean, Mary works at an advertising agency. So you see sort of, you know, behind the scenes of making ads and that sort of process, which speaks to the act of crafting images and the pressure that she has and the fact that because her roommate is a bum, she has to, you know, like make ends meet. Sort of working at the ad agency to do this, because it's very easy to throw insults saying you're selling yourself out. That's a pretty privileged position to do it if you're living at somebody's house for free who's paying the bills. So we also have images though, like around some of the protests. So, you know, for example, on page 31, we have Callum Race to this protest, which is taking place out front of the Alberta Legislature in Edmonton, which is where the provincial parliament meets. And there's a group of protesters, and you see a shot from a distance with a small group of protesters, and then you also see a shot of protesters zoomed in tight on them to try and juxtapose the framing, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're looking to show the protesters as being ineffective, you zoom out and you show like on the bottom of page 31 where there's not many people there, it looks kind of sparse. However, if you want to show them as being effective and mobilizing, you zoom in and you show a good number of them, and it looks sort of tight and interesting. Mm-hmm. So we have that there. And then another feature of this imaginary, the imagined space, are celebrities. And so we have one celebrity sort of show up. Think there's similarities to Leonardo DiCaprio, this idea, and he is somebody who in the struggle over the oil sands and tar sands has flown in and spoken on behalf of and to this issue, so that's another sort of issue in terms of aspect that is on the imagined space, are the aspects around celebrities. And in my own research, I've been quite interested in the power that the logic of celebrity has as a social movement strategy.
Mm. So the two characters in the book, Mary and Callum, they have this really interesting relationship. Yeah. Mary is working for an advertising agency. I'm assuming she's a woman of color based on the way she's represented in the book. And she's also a lesbian.
Yes.
And then you have Callum, who's basically living on her couch for free.
Yeah.
And hasn't paid the rent in a long time, but is an aspiring artist. We see him at the beginning at his kind of gallery opening. And so these two figures come together. We're not quite sure why they're even friends, because their relationship's kind of odd.
It is odd.
But they come together and they are sort of battling out this dialogue about who is right, like who has the upper moral hand and advantage in this discussion about sustainability politics, about what resources they're using on the planet, about what it means to tell lies. I mean, this is a trope that's kind of pulled through the graphic novel. So could you say a little bit more about this relationship and who these two characters represent in the context of this conversation you're trying to have around the All Times project?
It was an interesting conversation to have. Like, how do we have these characters? How are we going to represent people? And even the names, I mean, I think it was Hugh who came up with it, the names using Mary and Callum, which means peace. But we didn't want to have the typical sort of white male with a corporate job sort of going and trying to then be the savior for his friend, whether it was a male, female, white, black, what have you. So instead, we think about it is you think about the idea of privilege, and and Callum is unaware of the struggles that Mary has had to go through to get these type of jobs and keep these jobs, right? So precarity becomes an issue, and he's able to sort of leech off of that. And so for us, it was quite interesting to think about how easy it can be. I mean, to be part of a movement, sort of leech off others, not be aware of it. So even like he is unaware of the struggles that Mary is going through, and perhaps I don't think fully appreciates what she's able to provide. And she does this through her maybe a bit of guilt with her friendship, and a bit of a way to try and compensate for the work that she is doing. But they then have these serious sort of conversations throughout, and you don't find out to the end, like, you're right, like, how are they even friends? And yeah, we have that at the end where it's them coming to Fort McMurray from out east, and they were sort of friends from university. But yeah, I mean, personally, I would have kicked Callum out a long time ago. Yeah. I think many people might have, but it just having two individuals to be able to, we wanted to contrast the artist versus this person with the job, but also not just have it be an advertising job, but people, issues of having to pay the bills and live our lives, because that comes through. Like, we can critique oil, we can think about, yes, it's easy to turn off, so we should just turn off the taps, but to think about sort of the real life components around that is huge. And so Mary tries to be the voice of reason in all that, in my mind, and speaks to that. And in many ways, it's like Callum is much more sort of irrational, and Mary has her head on her shoulders in this instance.
And that's done in really subtle ways. I mean, there's a moment, thinking about precarity and privilege, there's a moment, for example, where Callum says that he wants to meet Mary for chicken wings, chicken wings. Yeah. And they go together to have these vegan, but then he arrives early and already starts eating and ordering before she arrives, and then leaves before her and tells her to pick up the tab.
I know.
And so it was such an interesting way of talking about privilege and how it works. And he's totally unaware of the way in which he's leeching off of this woman.
Yeah. He's not aware of privilege. He's aware of his art as an artist. He wants to be paid for his work, which I understand, but the privilege is this, like, oh, you can pick up the bill, you can do that, you know. It's something where, again, we wanted to talk about those issues was really it was fun to sort of think through these. And the challenge is, I mean, we had, you know, because my budget was based on per page, like, how the heck do we do this and like 100 pages and have these sort of elements? So there's so many things we wanted to try and squeeze in. And this is what was so great about working with Nicole and Hugh. Hugh has he's got a great ability to sort of do pithy sort of writing. Nicole introduced me to the Bechtel test, which I wasn't aware of. And so she's like, we have to make sure this makes its way into the story. And that does, which briefly, if I get it correct, it's about that two female characters talk to each other more about other topics than just male relationships. And so this is, I mean, Nicole's like, we got to make sure we have this. And of course, it's about the their advertising strategies, but it works its way in. So, I mean, also in this process, I learned a lot, but it was kind of fun to think through these elements. And I mean, I was Callum as that sort of protester, you know, like the 24-year-old organizing protest against the 2002 G8 summit, sleeping on couches, doing my master's at the same time, but sort of oblivious. That said, the summer after that, I ended up working at Petro-Canada for 4 months. And so...
Oh, so you've had both inside and outside.
And this was an important experience. So what's funny is that my affinity group, when I organized protests for the 2002 G8 summit, was called CRAP. And it was meant like Corporate Rule Advances Poverty. And I bought like a 3-piece pinstripe suit, and we all marched around in suits with these signs looking like corporate types. And I had to wear... my dad went to high school with the person who became the president of Petro-Canada, and he emailed him, is there a job for Patrick? So I got an interview there, and I had to wear the very pinstripe suit from a charity shop that I wore as my crap sort of corporate, like, Corporate Rule Advances Poverty to the interview. And then I got the job, so I worked there for a summer. And it's funny because when I was working there, I had a fellowship doing stuff, anti-war stuff as well. So I would sneak off in my lunch break and print out all these color posters from the F-15 protest against the Iraq War. But it was an interesting experience working at an oil company, and some of this works its way into here, in that before then, and as like a, somebody in this crap affinity group, I didn't humanize people working in oil corporations. Everybody was evil. It was an anti-capitalist, anti-globalization movement. And then you realize a lot of those people in those organizations care. And I was working specifically within corporate social responsibility, although this comic is critical of it, rightly so, I think. But it helped humanize the people there. And for me, that was an important perspective in thinking through the nuances and how we tell this story. So it was kind of funny sort of living in both worlds with that.
Yeah, I mean, the comic really grapples with this idea that nobody is one thing, and there's choices that you make that can take you to places that are unexpected. I mean, Mary offers Callum a job to join her while one of her photo shoots. So of course, you know, like she pulls him in.
Yeah.
And he agrees,
yeah.
even though he's like there from the outside saying solidarity. So, you know, that's what precarity does.
That's it. And then she owes him a bunch of money. So here's a way to get paid the money. And then she pulls him in. And unfortunately, that's sort of like, he screws her over as a result, too.
Spoiler alert.
That's right. But we need that sort of, we needed that sort of conflict. I mean, we talked for the longest time. How do we end this comic? And I mean, it's not like when we published it, we went through various sort of pre-testing or reading groups or things, we sort of needed to get it out. And there's some things I would sort of refine, like people would often ask, well, you know, what does Mary see when she's looking into the camera and why is she crying and these sorts of things. And part of it is we would need to think things through more, because this was also an experiment in like doing something with academic sort of work and themes.
Mm. The theme of Nord Media is about challenging the field this week, and intersectionality is a large part of the discussion, thinking across different and between different spaces and lines and modes of thinking. And so, of course, the Beast takes certain positions, but there are other hidden, silent voices that are not present. One of which is the Indigenous perspective. And of course, this whole novel is set on Indigenous land. Mm. So what were the conversations that you had about this missing perspective or this silent voice that isn't there?
That's a huge question. And it was something really big to struggle with, especially in, you know, a 100-page comic looking sort of this bifurcated space. Where is the space? Where are the Indigenous sort of voices, faces, bodies? And the Beast is based off of this oil sands image database. And so the themes in there come from the sort of images which are being put out there. And what is very noticeable is the absence of Indigenous campaigns. It's explainable, understandable, given the lack of resources, right? It takes a lot to run these sorts of advertising campaigns and social media posts. There are sort of parallels and elements where there are partnerships with NGO groups, but it doesn't go into, like, this comic, one of the big issues in Canada has to do with pipelines, and pipelines running across Indigenous land. I mean, Canada itself is a colonial country, right? The pipeline itself goes over land which is owned by and occupied by Indigenous peoples who have control of those land rights. But that is not something discussed in here, because I struggled with, do I just give a single sort of nod to this? How do I deal with these whole other sort of politics? So in many ways, the Beast replicates that sort of silence and that absence, and that was problematic for me. One of the inspirations for even thinking about sort of things in a creative way besides this After Oil sort of book was Terence Houle's work. And I saw him speak at an event called Is Oil a Dirty Word? And that was, it just was eye-opening. He said, if you want to know what apocalypse looks like, thinking about like post-apocalypse societies in the age of climate change, he says, look at my people. We've been living in a post-apocalyptic state since colonization. Mm-hmm. And he's right, you know. So what I do have is Terence's piece of work, his art, Oily Buffalo piece, which again made me sort of think, and then a short essay that he wrote to accompany it. So I have that as a space in there, which just tries to hold a bit of space to address the issue. It does not do it justice. There's some amazing comics, and I'll have to get the name so I mention them properly, who discussed some of these issues. But it was a struggle. I think Terence's essay sort of raises some important questions, and I would want any reading of The Beast to be supplemented with other sort of voices that deal with that, that deal specifically with Indigenous land rights issues and resources and such. Mm-hmm. There's an excellent scholar who is, I'm going to butcher the First Nation that he's from, who's a First Nation scholar. I'm not going to be able to do the name justice, but his name is Gord Hill, and he's done some comics. He's Canadian. He's out in British Columbia. Comics such as 500 Years of Resistance, the Antifa comic book, which is great, and Anti-Capitalist Resistance, three different comics as a First Nations comics book artist, but dealing with political issues. And those would be great sort of compliments or things to read, even like put the beast to one side and read his stuff for these sorts of perspectives.
Yeah. So we've been thinking about the beast together in the discussions that we had after your keynote, both in terms of the beast as it was described initially in the book, which is referring to the wildfires in 2016. Yeah. Could you say a little bit about that before we...
Yeah, in 2016, actually, I was supposed to go visit. I've never sort of seen the oil sands in person. I was supposed to go in May 2016. I planned a trip out there before this academic conference in Calgary. But in early May, the beast, which it became to be known as, was a wildfire, which started. It burnt uncontrollably until July of 2016. It wasn't put out for 13 months, caused over 6 billion euros in economic damage, destroyed 2,500 homes. And it was very symbolic because it hit Fort McMurray, which is sort of the oil producing capital. So some people saw it as a karmic reckoning on this fossil fuel producing community. Others saw it as sort of, you know, destroying the livelihoods of sort of blue collar workers working in the oil sands. Blue collar workers making, you know, six figure salaries, but nonetheless workers and Canadians as well. So it was this, raised a lot of discussion and debate over the symbolism behind it. But the other important thing is that climate change has resulted in drier forests, along with the ways in which these forests are managed, means they can burn more. And there's science and articles that we can read around that. But then people wanted to use this opportunity to talk about climate change. And that became contentious because, oh, we can't talk about climate change in the context of this fire. It's disrespectful to the victims. And to me, you know, like, you think about the media opportunity that opens up to discuss these issues. That is the chance to talk about it, but in a civil way. But we haven't been able to reckon with that. And I think, you know, as climate change hits closer to home and hits Western bodies more, are we going to sort of stay silent and say, oh, we can't talk about this now, we'll talk about it later? Or are we going to use this as a chance to talk about the system and solutions? And it'll be interesting to see what happens.
So the beast, in a way, becomes quite an unwieldy kind of big looming metaphor for catastrophe in varying kinds of ways. But we also made the connection to the beast possibly being academia.
Sure, yeah, of course, yeah.
Which is another unwieldy entity.
<vicious. laughs>
Another unwieldy entity that that we have to grapple with as we attempt to teach in interesting ways and produce knowledge and share what we have researched in new and exciting and compelling ways. So could you say something a bit about the comic as a mode of translation of your own research as an academic and what the possibilities are, what the challenges are?
To be honest, I'm a tenured professor, a tenured associate professor, and without tenure, I probably would not have been able to do this. Or if I did do it, I'd have to have a lot of other publications to back it up. I did it at the same time as writing academic articles, but it was sort of the privilege of my position which allowed me to do this. Because a tenure committee, this is the beast will end up being on the last page of your CV under other. Right? And in many ways, sometimes people, the department was happier to see an interview in the LA Review of Books than they were the comic, right? You know, and a weird sort of thing how academia works is that the fact I get to give sort of a lecture here ends up higher on the CV and page numbers than where the comic itself will be. It'll literally be like eight pages afterwards. So it's something where it opens up a conversation of who can do these sorts of things. And I think we, as we sort of become more senior academics, have a few responsibilities, but I can think of two offhand. One is to sort of mentor students that we can, master students, PhD students, newer academics in doing their work, provide opportunities for them, but also sort of change how institutions view these types of publications, right? So when we see packages and we recognize there is community involvement, that is important, especially if you're taking research and then you're engaging in the community in a different way, trying to engage in conversations. And by saying that, I don't mean all this emphasis, all this language we're seeing now on impact and what is your impact and putting stuff out. No, you know, it's thinking like, what are some, how can we reach people to try and sort of get them engaged and interested in these issues? And if impact comes from that, great, but not thinking of impact as this stupid box that has to be filled out in a grant, but honestly thinking about it, how can we sort of reach and tell stories? But I do think it's like recognizing that I'm getting older. I got my PhD 10 years ago now, like I can try and sort of change some dialogues in stuff, even if it just comes to assessing tenure files and assessing peer-reviewed publications for sure, but also then recognizing, acknowledging the work that goes into sort of other elements.
Yeah. So do you have any tips for people who would be interested in embarking on this kind of project outside of the walls of the university? What would you advise in terms of collaborating with artists or meeting a publisher, a comic books publisher of this kind? What were the things that you've learned during this process?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not somebody who was able to sort of to draw. Perhaps I could have worked on the story. So I found partners who I could work with. It was important for me that the partners got funded properly and funded what they asked for. And so the first thing is, I mean, the first rule is pay your artists, right? Like if you're using an image, you're using a photo in your book. Even if you're using a photo in a journal article, pay that artist for his or her work. In terms of other partnerships, then it's thinking through what are the economics. Something I didn't discuss is that we did do a crowdfunder component of this, and Ad Astra did that as a way to supplement the printing and diminish for them the financial risk of printing the thousands of copies, the 3,000 copies that they did. Because when I paid them for the work, it was paying them for the digital comic. I wanted the digital comic. I wanted it to be out and free. So they did crowdfunding. But in many ways, I mean, crowdfunding is like just this putting responsibility on friends and family to subsidize our work. And I'm glad it was for them and not subsidizing me, as again, a tenured professor paid for by the public. I don't need the cash on it, but it might be an additional way to make something happen. But to think creatively with partnerships. And I think part of it is finding, how do we find ways to get artists paid for their work? There are PhDs who have incredible talents, who can make films, make vignettes, do art, do exhibits, and there can be ways which can complement their academic writing and show it in a different way. And I think there's audiences for it and interest in it as well.
So this apocalyptic future is coming faster than we would hope.
Yeah.
And it's kind of scary for people. I know I personally have an environmental panic attack. Like, well, it used to be once a week and now it's like almost every day. Can art really save us?
Yeah, it's a great question. My daughter said to me the other day, she said, Daddy, no, actually, I don't think I can tell the story. she said, Daddy, you're really lucky. No, I can't tell the story. she said, Daddy, you're really lucky. I'm going to die before you. And I thought, holy shit, where are you getting that from, right? Yeah. This idea that this apocalyptic imagery is making its way out there. Now, that's probably not going to happen. It's going to be sort of people in sort of southern areas who are going to feel things first, but that these intensities are coming. I think art plays an important role for us to think about sort of the imagination and what is needed. You know, I remember like doing a climate change campaigning back in like 2002 about like the boiled frog, that analogy, and it still holds true, right? Like the thing is, we do have a Greta Thunberg movement in many cities in Canada. People mobilize. But the lights still work, the internet still work, we still have gas at the station. I mean, the biggest debate right now in Canada is about the carbon tax and the fact that it adds another 10 cents to petrol, right? The thing is, the politicians are debating the price at the pump and not the science behind what a carbon tax does. Nobel-winning science, right? And the fact that this is meant to be as a deterrent, because humans are not rational animals. We need to try and like, curve behavior. So I think these narratives are very important through art to open up a space. That means research is still super important. You think about when we have TV shows like Chernobyl or other sort of elements, or reading Margaret Atwood's trilogy, like Oryx and Crake, or what have you, like opening up a space to then want to learn more and think about these things. So there's certainly a place for it. But at the end of the day, also, I mean, the response is, well, I can't eat art, right? So I have to, so, you know, you see a lot of artists go work in ad agencies to do their passion. So how do we, yeah, how do we do this? And in Canada, I really don't see this space for discussion. It really is a polarized publics, and things are sort of comfortable. Gas is a little bit more expensive. Bread's a bit more expensive. It's like this boiled frog is there, and where things tip over, I don't know. I mean, you know, it isn't until there is disaster that people talk about things. Think about like Grenfell in London. You can look at, like, since Thatcher's time, you could look at the atrophy of the state, and it's captured in this tragedy, and people don't sort of see it until it's manifest, and people die as a result, right? Like, it's, and we're seeing this now. And that's why I think when we think about the need to discuss this convergence of disaster events, crisis, communication, and climate change as things hit closer to home, is that what it takes? I don't know, because at that point, is it too late? So I think we need to sort of sit through and let's see what sort of interventions that we can have.
But you're still optimistic.
Well, you have to be. You know? Yeah, I think so.
Thank you so much for coming and talking with us, and thank you for your presence here in Malmö.
Thank you.